You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SevillePodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Regular listeners of our podcasts might know Rick Britton. He's a Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer. An award-winning historian, Rick also organizes a Civil War lecture and day trip series in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. On Wednesday, July 20th, 2011, Troy Marshall spoke about the brilliant campaign that made Stonewall Jackson famous. Through May and early June of 1862, Jackson and his 17,000-man foot cavalry outmarched, outmaneuvered, and outfought several federal forces, totaling over 60,000 men. This is part four of a six-part series for 2011. Here's Troy Marshall.
Thank you, Rick.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming, buddy.
Well, folks, he's taller than me. Folks, I don't know if I can follow something that good. I was looking at your repertoire here, you know, the ballroom dancing and all the fun stuff, and I said, Stonewall Jackson's ballet campaign? Boy, I've got some big things to follow. But yes, I am the new director, actually 2 weeks, so I'm still shiny down at the battlefield. And we've changed the name of our museum from the Hall of Valor Civil War Museum, which for some people meant a certain thing, and we were able at the battlefield to figure that out, to the Virginia Museum of the Civil War, because we figured when you're in the Commonwealth or when you're without the Commonwealth, you look for things like the Virginia Transportation Museum, the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, the Virginia Science Museum. And so, you know, Virginia did not have a Civil War museum per se. And it dawned on us that, you know, we are Virginia's only state-owned Civil War museum. There are lots of Civil War attractions and museums, big and small, but one that focuses comprehensively on Virginia. And so that's really a really good opportunity for us. So kind of excited about that. So really, you're going to see new signage and some new brochures to also usher in a new age within the park. The Stonewall Jackson House in Lexington has joined VMI Museum operations. So the staff that you know and love will still be there. Michael Ann Lynn will still be the executive director, but it'll be under VMI's operations. So once again, it's kind of everything is starting to gel, it seems. I'd like to start this evening by making a simple statement. Virginia's place in history of the Civil War is really paramount, period. It's truly no contest. It's true that many battles were fought elsewhere, you know, just to name a few, Shiloh, Antietam, Lookout Mountain, major battles, Gettysburg, Atlanta. But from the first major battle at Manassas to the surrender at Appomattox, no single state is really going to see as much combat, more comprehensively, more in your face, more where you can visit today than the Commonwealth. Stonewall Jackson's 62 Valley Campaign is still studied at schools great and small as a textbook example of things like charismatic leadership, martial energy, initiative, deception, and good maps and intelligence against superior numbers. A thorough survey of the Valley Campaign in under an hour is really a Herculean task. So I simply want to provide a broad brush treatment of this, and I hope that I don't steal too much of your thunder. But I'm very much a visual learner, and if there are visual learners here, you know, we'll all unite. I like looking at pictures and maps and artifacts in a visual way, because when you go to the Valley, especially when you go to, let's say, Rockingham County, it is so big. You can really get a sense of those battles at Cross Keys and Port Republic. So let us begin with kind of just a broad brush approach. And pardon me for chasing a rabbit or two. Why is Virginia so important when the Confederacy is formed? It was the most populous southern state. It was revered as the cradle of American liberty. And as such, Virginia gave the Confederacy really a philosophical linkage to the Revolution. Indeed, many Southerners are going to see the crisis of 61 as kind of like the Second American Revolution. By making Richmond its capital, the Confederate government ensured the Old Dominion is going to be the center of the South's political universe and also a crosshair on the Commonwealth of Virginia. And what I've got here is a little bit hard to see, but it's the line from the Bonnie Blue Flag, the fifth verse, that says, "And here's to brave Virginia, the old Dominion state, and with the young Confederacy at length has linked her fate. Impelled by her example, now other state prepare to hoist on high the Bonnie Blue Flag that bears a single star." So all the other lines there, when they get to Virginia, it's so important because Virginia has an important role to play in the Confederacy. And Virginia has many, many regions, as we'll be finding out here. Of course, in Richmond there, you got the Tredegar Iron Works. There was also another one called Bologna. The Shenandoah Valley, you've got all kinds of produce, horses, apples, mules, wheat. But let's not forget about other military things, like the salt works down at Saltville, which is going to maintain military stores. And you've also got in Wythe County, you've got the lead mines. And these are actual period images of folks working in the salt works and folks working. It's a stylized image of those working in the lead mines down in southwest Virginia. 1861. Just to kind of bring you up on speed, a little review. April 17th, after several weeks of spirited debates, the Secession Committee is going to meet in Richmond to take the Commonwealth out of the Union. Now, this is prior to the bombardment of Fort Sumter. And so what you're going to end up with are three gentlemen that are going to try to, you know, broker some kind of a deal. William Ballard Preston, George Wythe Randolph, and Alexander H.H. Stewart. But they're representing three different factions, and they're also going to have a problem because by the time they get ready to go up with John Tyler in tow, Fort Sumter has already been bombarded, and the call for volunteers is going to take place. Now, the state of Virginia is going to move very quickly to mobilize its forces. And I love this little cartoon here of the voluntary manner in which some of the volunteers, obviously a northern newspaper, you know, and you've got implements of torture hanging up there. You've got bayonets pushing a guy in and a guy looking like Colonel Rick Britton behind the barrel there. This guy over here with the dog kind of urinating on his foot. I mean, so like I said, probably not an accurate portrayal of what's going on. But you've got new volunteers, and many of these militia units have been energized by Brown's raid in 1859. So you're going to have all of these new recruits under an able leader, Robert Edward Lee. And, of course, this is an image that we all tend to forget about. I think a lot of us think that he came, you know, into this world looking with gray hair, wearing a gray suit. Now, Virginia is also going to provide a lot of able leadership. And I don't need to even say these names here because you recognize them. But the one that we're going to be talking about tonight is what I call the master of the Shenandoah Valley, General Stonewall Jackson, even before he was Stonewall Jackson. Now, where does that name stick to the brigade and by proxy stick to him? Well, it's actually at the Battle of Manassas. You know, a scorching sun was reaching its zenith on the 21st as, you know, the disorganized regiments of infantry retreated to Henry House Hill. And you can actually see Henry House Hill there. It's kind of right in the, let's see if I can do this. Oh, I'm blocking the whole thing. Kind of right there. And the day's fighting had begun at dawn. Union forces commanded by Irvin McDowell attacked across Bull Run. Soldiers from Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina reached the summit, and they encountered General T.J. Jackson's 1st Virginia Brigade, 9 pieces of artillery. And that's when you have South Carolina General Barnard B. approach Jackson, who was seating calmly on his horse, and exclaimed, "The enemy are driving us." To this, Jackson replied,
"Sir, we will give them the bayonet."
Thank you, thank you. Pay that man in the back there. Works out. So, exhorting his troops to reform, B. then inadvertently coined one of the most famous nicknames in American history by saying,
"There stands Jackson like a stone wall." Well,
yeah, let's all do that. 1, 2, 3. "There stands Jackson like a stone wall."
Rally around.
Very good. So there's your General B, and there's the rally coming up, and there's a nice famous image of Jackson there, and another shot. So like I said, this is kind of a preamble to what we're talking about. It's going to mark a turning point in the journey of a man that rose from really the humblest of beginnings. And of course, you've probably all read, you know, the famous book by, you know, James I. Robertson on Stonewall Jackson. And so the man is going to endure repeated personal loss, but he's got a fervent religious faith and an iron determination that's going to forge a career. So what I'd like to do is just kind of travel his road for just a second. And this is just a map showing that part of Western Virginia where Jackson's going to be. And of course, you've got an image right here of Jackson's mill there. He was born January 21st of 24 in Clarksburg, now West Virginia. And I'm just going to go down. He was the third child of Julia Neal Jackson and Jonathan Jackson. And he was orphaned, living with various relatives. He and his younger sister stayed the longest with their uncle Cummings Jackson at his mill in Lewis County, West Virginia. There's an image of it right there. What's interesting is, apparently young Tom worked a variety of jobs around the mill and received rudimentary education. It is said that he made a deal with one of his uncle's slaves to get pine knots in exchange for reading lessons. And then, of course, we go into really a new era in his life. You know, with limited financial resources and few options, he is going to secure an appointment at the United States Military Academy in 1842. And you can see the Hudson there. Congressman Samuel Hayes, to which he was related by marriage. The appointment occurred only after the congressman's first choice, an acquaintance of Jackson named Gibson Butcher, abruptly left the point after a single day. Now, who's heard of Gibson Butcher? Nobody. But you've heard of Jackson, so I mean, he missed, you know, his calling by his natural avocation by one person. Being less prepared academically, Jackson began at the bottom of his class. He graduated 17th out of 59 cadets in 1846. Many believe that if the course had lasted one more year, he would have been the top of his class. So you're getting an idea of the person who, when he takes over the valley, his personal character, and so. Some images of some cadets and fellow classmates of which you might recognize. You know, McClellan and Powell Hill, Cadmus Wilcox there, kind of at the bottom, third from the left. So, Lieutenant Jackson begins his Army career as a second lieutenant in the 1st Artillery, sent to fight in the Mexican War. At the Siege of Veracruz, in the battles of Contreras, Chapultepec, and Mexico City, eventually earns him two brevet promotions and a regular rank, Army rank of first lieutenant. During the assault on Chapultepec, he refused what he felt was a bad order to withdraw his troops. Confronted by his superior, he explained his rationale. Calmly withdrawing was more hazardous than continuing his overmatched artillery duel. So once again, you're getting an idea of really the nature of Jackson. The end of hostilities in Mexico brought occupation duty, during which he developed a lifelong fondness for Spanish language and culture, and he even briefly considered making a life for himself in Mexico. So, like I said, there's the left, the right, the center path that we all take in our lives, and it would have been very interesting had he stayed in Mexico. Instead, he remained in the Army and served in both New York and Florida for the next 3 years. It was at Fort Meade, Florida, that Jackson became embroiled in a conflict with his superior, and it was over protocol, Captain Benjamin French, and this literally is going to go all the way to the commanding general of the Army. Both men shared some measure of blame for the situation, but Jackson's pride and certainty of being right compounded with the idea that he was probably bored with the peacetime Army really made it tough for him. So where do you go? Well, guess what? The opportunity for a new start came in the spring of 51 when Jackson joined the faculty of the Virginia Military Institute, which was established in 1839 under Superintendent Francis H. Schmidt. And VMI was the first state-supported military school in the nation. So once again, it was an opportunity for him to get out of Florida, to maybe refocus a little bit. Actually, that wasn't what I wanted to go. Oh, yeah, it was. Jackson's other role was an instructor in artillery. He actually taught two things. You might know this. One was natural and experimental philosophy. I looked the textbook up, and it's about five different disciplines today. It's optics, galvanism, magnetism, electromagnetism. So it's physics. It's a lot of that stuff. And apparently Jackson wasn't the best prof. We actually have at the VMI Museum a student's textbook, and there's a caricature of Jackson. You know, there's Tom Fool Jackson. But the class that they loved to watch him do was artillery tactics. And you can see the red carriages of what will be later dubbed the four Gospels there, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They were painted red to denote their ownership by the Commonwealth of Virginia. They're like two-thirds scale cannon, so the cadets can move them around very easily as a unit. And those in the parade ground area is where he's actually going to be teaching that. Now, in the aftermath of the defeat, the Union Army, and this is after Manassas, the Union Army Potomac is going to be reorganized, and you see troops being refitted by McClellan. And, of course, once again, McClellan was good at what? Organization, right? You need those folks, right? You need the one that are going to count the beans and get you, you know, what you need. But does that necessarily mean that, you know, you can be a good field commander? Well, like I said, he sat a horse well. He had a charismatic persona. Jackson had a charismatic persona. So we're going to see which type of leadership style is going to go the furthest. And so once again, some other images of, you know, Little Mac being surrounded by officers in resplendent uniforms. Now, I wanted to talk about, you know, Jackson's riding somewhat of a high after Manassas, even though it's really the brigade that's earned so much of that credit, but it kind of stuck to him. And so he decides to go on a cold march over the mountain. And what cold march do you think that would be? Help me out, Buffs. Yes. Thank you. Romney. So you get an idea of that mountainous terrain. So in late December, Jackson proposes a joint venture between General William Loring's men and his own to Romney to drive a wedge between the Federals. So you have Federals in the Alleghenies and Banks' men. So January 1st, Jackson takes 7,500 volunteers, 2,000 militia, and about 650 cavalry. They leave Winchester for operations to the west. Now, the men were forced to march in bitter winter weather. There's a picture of Jackson there and some example of what the weather might have looked like. And so on the way, General Loring exploded and he made a very famous speech. By God, sir, this is the damnedest outrage ever perpetrated in the annals of history, keeping my men out here in the cold without food. Jackson placed Loring's brigade at Romney to secure the Long Branch Valley. The brigade, Stonewall Brigade, was ordered back to Winchester. Well, you can imagine that didn't sit very well. And you're all Civil War buffs, so you know there was a big row between Loring and his men. And almost in a modern drama, once again, if you're disenfranchised, you take it to the powers that be. Now, they didn't have internet and YouTube and Twitter, so they're not tweeting about this, but basically, 11 officers on the 25th of January signed a petition calling Jackson's competency as a leader into question. Secretary of War Benjamin ordered Jackson to relocate Loring's men without delay. Jackson quipped, "With such interference, I can't expect to be of much service in the field, and accordingly respectfully request to be ordered to report for duty at the superintendent of the Virginia Military Institute. Should this application not be granted, I respectfully request that the president will accept my resignation." Here's another close call for Jackson, because he feels like he's being, you know, manipulated and maneuvered, and it's literally going to take an entreaty of from John Letcher, the governor, to the Secretary of War with the pressure from Congressman Boteler to finally get him to recant, and Jackson stays in the Army. Now, if you looked at people's perception of Jackson in that early winter of 1862, how do you think they perceive him? Is it the hero that we see at the end of the Battle of Port Republic? No, it's almost as if, okay, yeah, maybe this guy, you know, maybe Tom Fool Jackson actually stuck to him. But once again, it's going to be something that Jackson deals with. And there's a picture of Loring. And so he must have had to contemplate very dearly. Now, we're going into 62, where I want to bring us up to speed on the actions to the east, because the actions to the east dictate what's going to go on in the valley. So despite his caution, McClellan had managed by June to bring his 100,000-man army to within a few miles of Richmond, dangerous place to be for the Confederacy. And Union success seems assured. However, Stonewall Jackson is going to intervene. You might say, well, how could a small army deal with that? Well, I can tell you that for much of the war, Lincoln's, one of his big concerns was that what if D.C. was attacked by a rogue element, perhaps from the valley, perhaps from some other quarter? And so 70,000 troops are manning these extensive fortifications in that square that you know, going around, you can see the little Fort Totten, Fort Smith there, all those particular forts. Lincoln held back some 50,000 men from McClellan as a further precaution. So it's, I guess, the defensive offense type of a thing. And so here's where Jackson enters. Now, playing on Lincoln's fears, he was ordered to engage federal forces in the Shenandoah Valley with the intention of tying up as many troops as he could, otherwise pledged to McClellan. Now, in the image, you can see General Fremont over here. That's going to be commanding a force of about 15,000 when he gets ready to come in. General Banks up here, he got a force of about 18,000. And then there's McDowell sitting over there with almost 40,000. And finally, General Shields is going to be leaving that command and entering with 10,000. So it means mission impossible. So in February 62, Jackson's position is increasingly untenable. So Congress authorized another kick in the teeth was that Congress authorized a 30-day furlough for all the one-year troops. So you got all these troops in the wings, and then, oh, by the way, your good shooters, your good veterans, they get to go home for a month. Perfect timing, right? So the approaches to Bath and Romney were taken. The hamlet of Romney itself was taken by Union forces. Major General Nathaniel Banks, his corps occupies Harper's Ferry on the 24th. Once again, now Winchester is untenable. We've got to leave there. General Joseph E. Johnston of the Confederate Army orders Jackson to fall back as he himself left Centerville. So there's this kind of turn of fate, if you will. Now, Jackson has a mere 4,000 infantry, 600 cavalry, and 27 guns against Banks' 25,000 men. Maybe a more cautious person would have thrown his hands up and said, I can't do this. You don't pay me enough to do this. Well, let's see what Jackson did. Well, here's one of the things Jackson's men do. They march fast, using surprise, and they seem to be everywhere. One Union soldier referred to them as Confederate boomerangs. Now, that's a period term, because they seem to, they just were everywhere. And we'll talk about, you know, why that is. Now, first what I want to talk about is Kernstown. As Jackson fell back to the hamlet of Mount Jackson, Banks is feeling good about things in the valley. He has good reason to. Jackson was not seen as a threat. Banks knew that he had a small force, but Banks totally misunderstood Jackson's character, thinking that he was whipped. The Valley Campaign is really going to begin at Kernstown, although some historians would argue that it actually started later Kernstown, because it really is going to be a reverse for Jackson. But there's a silver lining, which I'll talk about. So on March 23rd, and you can see in the map there, you've got Kernstown right above March 23rd. You've got Jackson, who's fallen back, and now he's heading back up. Faulty intelligence and poor communication from his cavalry commander, Colonel Turner Ashby, is going to lead Jackson really to the only, what you might call, a defeat. And he did leave the field. Ashby reported that the size of the opposing force there, right at Kernstown, was only four regiments, or 3,000 men. That was what the report that Jackson received. In point of fact, the Union force commanded by Colonel Nathan Kimball totaled 9,000 men. So a little bit more than the three. Jackson's own force numbered about 3,400 men. He confidently maneuvered north and in position about 1 p.m. Ashby is thrown back. Now, maybe that's a red flag. Okay, whoa, something's going on here. Ashby's thrown back, later reinforced by a brigade. Jackson moved the two other brigades he had towards the Union right flank, but was hit hard by Colonel Tyler's brigade. So we'll show you the lay of the land. Now, of course, the features there, you see Pritchard's Hill, kind of right above Kimball. And then over on the left there, Jackson put Garnet's men, Fulkerson, there. And it's a stone wall there. And the stone wall is preserved in pieces at the Kernstown Battlefield Association and at Rose Hill. Thank you, sir. I left them out at home. You're too kind, sir. So, let's see if I can cut it on. There we go. So, there is Fulkerson's line. There's the stone wall. There is Pritchard's Hill, the two main features of the battle there. So, Kimball is going to move against Jackson's right. And really, just you can see Kimball right over here starting to go right against that line there. And Jackson actually has to redeploy off of that field. Now, this defeat, and it is a defeat, paid Jackson dividends as a tactical victory. Lincoln is bothered by this action, so that really so close to the Capitol, that he's going to dispatch extra troops to the Valley at McClellan's expense. So you're talking about Confederate casualties, about 718 combined, Union casualties, about 590. And I wanted to show you what that line looks like. And so what you're seeing, folks, is there's that stone wall there going like this, and there are Tyler's men going up against Fulkerson's line there. And at the site at Rose Hill, they've actually had a stonemason repairing the wall, which had been there. It just fell down over time. And so now they have a section that is built to the rule. And so it doesn't look like the crumbly wall I remember seeing years ago. It's actually a fortified type of a position. So Kernstown, now once again, you have a choice. You can say, I'm defeated, I'm going to give up. Does that sound like Jackson? No, that's not Jackson. So he's going to move. And the next one we're going to be talking about is the Battle of McDowell. Like I said, he's not going to just reform and run his head against the anvil at Kernstown. He's going to find another, he's going to draw attention away from another attack. So the Battle of McDowell here, and you can see the two commanders. You have Robert Schenck there to the top, right over here. That one right there. And then Robert H. Milroy are the two commanders that are going to be engaged there. So you have Schenck and Milroy both have about 6,500 men. Jackson brings about 6,000 men. So for a change, you're getting almost a parity there. Now, Jackson is going to advance in the direction of McDowell on May 7th. He divides his force in hopes of enveloping the Union forces on Shenandoah Mountain. Milroy falls back to McDowell. He did leave a section of artillery atop Shaw's Ridge, which might just be off that map there. So on the approaches there, Shaw's Ridge was kind of a high ground. If the map was bigger, you'd be able to see it, to retard any advance. Now, at dawn on May 8th, Jed Hotchkiss is going to reconnoiter the Union position as Major General Allegheny Johnson leads his men up to Sitlington's Hill. And you can see Sitlington's right over here. There you go. So what's interesting is that as he comes over the crest there, he actually gets a good view of that. And so Schenck is going to arrive on Milroy's left. You can see that right over here. And the Union officers deploy skirmishers towards the base of Sitlington's Hill, and scouts report that the enemy was attempting to bring guns up to the top here. Now you have a choice. You've got some troops on station. It's not the whole army. There are guns coming up, which is going to make your life difficult. Option A, you just take it or leave. Option B is you use something called a spoiling attack. Now, what do you think a spoiling attack might be? Well, the idea is, let's say it's kind of like, think about yourself getting set up for Christmas, okay? You've got your tree half up, and then the grandkids come and they descend on it, okay? And they break the balls. That's a spoiling attack, by the way. It's going to prevent you from completing your Christmas tree. Well, the idea here, quite simply, is if we attack with what we've got on the field right now, we can prevent those guns from getting there. We might surprise Jackson. We might steal his initiative. So let's see how it worked. So skirmishers deploy towards Sitlington's Hill. Milroy is going to advance with his whole brigade, four Ohio regiments, one from West Virginia, about 2,300 men, and he leads it personally Milroy does. The battle back and forth lasts for about 4 hours. Now, Jackson has 9 Confederate regiments with battling with only 5. So it's really not a great fight. And you have to, this map doesn't do justice. It is hilly. There's some flat ground, but there's a lot of up ground and a lot of down ground. So just the fatigue of going over those mountains and having to deal with all that are a really big issue. So that Union forces are going to fall back under the cover of darkness to McDowell, and Schenck and Milroy lead a general withdrawal on the 9th at about 2 a.m. So they've decided they've had enough. Now, the spoiling attack, in hindsight, did really surprise Jackson, but he couldn't drive him from the higher ground. It was pure Jacksonian strategy. Concentrate against a smaller foe and pitch into him and try to destroy him. I mean, you're going to find that over and over and over again. So if you see him leaving, the moral of the story is, and the moral that Schenck and Milroy could say if they could tweet is, don't underestimate this plain-looking guy who just doesn't have as many rifles, because, like I said, don't underestimate him. So you're talking problem for Union forces. Now, what I want to talk about now is a site that you're actually going to be going to, and that's Front Royal. Front Royal, when you see this image, and this is from May 20th, and it shows Banks's troops entering the outskirts of Front Royal. Front Royal had a rural character to it, but Front Royal was also an urban fight. It's being fought in streets and over bridges and things like that. So don't be fooled into thinking that it was, you know, kind of like a Port Republic, although it did have some elements of that. Now, Jackson is going to waste little time. I don't want to do that. Isn't technology wonderful? There we go. So we see this coming back up to Front Royal on May 23rd, kind of right here. You can see Front Royal right there. Just imagine the distance. I've driven this Valley campaign, and in this economy, you would go broke almost putting gas in the car. Well, imagine your feet having to carry that at a mile an hour or a half a mile an hour, whatever your marching speed is. So Jackson is going to waste little time, and go ahead and go to the next map here. A little bit grainy, but I just wanted you to see the Shenandoah River. There's a rail line, so you have the Shenandoah River. Here's Front Royal. Here's the Shenandoah River. Here is the rail line coming here. Here's Buckton Depot there. So he wastes a little time after McDowell. He is riding kind of a high right now. On the 21st, he joins Major General Richard Ewell, let me go back, actually in Luray. So clearly a new attack is in the works here, and he's got more troops. The battle at Front Royal, Banks is going to concentrate near Strasburg with about 9,000 men. Colonel John Kinley is in Front Royal with 1,063 men and 2 guns. A tempting target. Now, you got to realize, it looks flat here, but look at these mountains, okay? So here's Banks. Here is the Massanutten Mountain. Newmarket is really your only usable gap. I live on the side of that, by the way, and the original character of that mountain is still there. There are other little goat treks and horse paths that mule treks that you could get over, but if you want to get over quick, Newmarket is the place to go. So basically, he's going to lure or attempt to lure Banks to the south so he can do an end run and nail Kinley up in Front Royal. So Ashby's cavalry is going to be skirmishing with Banks up here, okay, in this area, and then he's going to hightail it down here and go through that Newmarket Gap in the attempt to drag him. A cat-and-mouse game indeed. Now, Colonel Mumford's cavalry is sent to close off Manassas Gap. So once again, you've got that Manassas Gap that you want to control over here too. So that's going to be under control. On the 23rd, though, Confederate troopers under Ashby, which would be the 7th Virginia, and Flournoy, the 6th Virginia, turn west, cross the South Fork of the Shenandoah, while the infantry is going to continue up to the Ashbury Chapel. The Ashbury Chapel is still there. The road that the cavalry is going to take, where they splash across, is also still there. It's a kind of a dirt trek. if you know where you're looking. Now, Jackson puts Taylor's brigade with the 1st Maryland Infantry and Wheat's Louisiana Battalion out in front. They're going to clear the town of skirmishers. Let me go forward again to my, sorry for the graininess on that. But you can see the cavalry over here. So this is 7th and 6th Cavalry. My third great-grandfather was in the 6th Cavalry under Flournoy. And would have been at that point right over here at Front Royal. Actually, I don't want to do that. Right over here at Front Royal. You can, like I said, you can see the rivers and the rail hub. So after they clear the skirmishers, it didn't take long, they're going to meet artillery fire from Camp Hill. And Camp Hill is kind of hard to see, but it's kind of over in this general area. And so they're going to start to receive fire from Camp Hill. Well, what are you going to do? The cavalry is over here at Buckton Depot, which is right here. So now they're set up to do a pincer movement. And so the 6th Virginia advances towards Kinley's rear. At that point, it becomes untenable. So what you're going to have is that there are two bridges, and I wish I had a better picture of those bridges crossing the Shenandoah there. They cross the North and the South River bridges, and they try to burn it, but they're not able to get them alight. Kinley finally is going to make a last stand near the McKay House, where he himself is wounded. Kinley surrenders over 700 men, and what you get out of this is Jackson's casualties are about 50. U.S. casualties total about 904. Now, let's go back to that earlier map. There we go. So, where's Banks at? Yeah, Banks is over here. Here's Front Royal. And so, guess what? A bad day's coming for Banks, as we're about to find out. And here's why. If you haven't figured it out already, folks, the terrain is what makes the Valley Campaign so spectacular. You know, I'm sure, if you don't know, Rick is going to tell you about it. Jedediah Hotchkiss, who was a great topographical map maker, he was a cartographer and an topographical engineer, he had such a high-quality map. I believe it was, 8 feet long when they laid the pieces out. So imagine you're a Union force, your commander, like Banks, and you've got this, maybe your stock, like you go to the gas station kind of a map, you know, that's like, now where am I on? Well, Jackson has a tremendously hyper-accurate map of all the holes and hollows and roads. And so, once again, plus there's pretty good reliable intelligence from signal stations at various points along the Massanutten. So that's going to really pay dividends for Jackson. So now we have Winchester, and it's going to be a match, if you will, between Nathaniel P. Banks, who is this gentleman over here looking very resplendent, as they tended to in the valley, and Jackson over here. May 24th, as I said, was a day of setbacks for the General Nathaniel P. Banks. He learns of Kinley's defeat at Front Royal, and he beat a hasty retreat northward where he was attacked by Jackson's troops. So here's Banks. He's going to be going up this road, and look. Okay, these troops here are waiting to slow him down any way they can. So Jackson attacks him at Newtown and at Middletown, and you can see Newtown right here. Middletown is right over here. So it's going to be a tough singular track. I think the Army calls that today a linear danger area. Okay, you got one way to get someplace, you're in trouble. And so the Confederates are going to capture so much equipment, equipage, military stores, that he's later dubbed Commissary Banks. And you can imagine, not only do the soldiers get to use this, but I've read period accounts of people as far as Stanton after the Battle of Winchester is a defeat for Banks. It's kind of like, you know, the blue light special is on, and they're going to Winchester to buy, you know, paper collars and medical supply. I mean, it was literally like the store was open. So, like I said, what happens to the military affects the civilians for good or ill. So, Banks deployed two brigades under Donnelly and Gordon at Winchester to slow the Confederate advance. At dawn on the 25th, Ewell's division was astride the Front Royal Pike. Okay, so, you know, there's the Front Royal Pike kind of coming up. This right over there. There's the Front Royal Pike Road right here. Threatening the Union left flank, Jackson led the Stonewall Brigade northward on the Valley Pike. So Jackson is going to be coming up here. Bank had moved some artillery further east to enfilade the Confederate guns, but Jackson sends the Louisiana Brigade plus a couple of other regiments to sweep Bowers Hill. And I don't know if this map has Bowers Hill, but it's a very key feature of... No, I don't see it. Maybe it's on the other map. Do I have another map? Let's see. Nope. No, I didn't want to go there just yet. Let's see. So, Bowers Hill is going to be hotly contested by Jackson's infantry and artillery. Banks moves his artillery further to the east to enfilade those guns. The Louisiana Brigade is going to sweep it. Jackson's line becomes irresistible, causing a tremendous blow just as Ewell pressures the enemy's left. Once again, pincer movements. It works. Why change it? If you can use deception, if you can split your force and have them hit. The problem with the pincer movement is if one doesn't hit the other, it's like one guy clapping, okay? Doesn't really work. So the casualties here are about 400 for Jackson's force and 2,019 for Banks. Now, not all of those are killed. So Winchester is a victory. There's Southerners. Now, if you'll learn something about Winchester. It wasn't solidly one or the other, depending on when you were there. There were a lot of secessionist ladies. That's what the Unionists would say. There's also a lot of Unionists in there. And so you get, whenever the Confederates would come in, the Unionists would hide in shame. Whenever the Union forces were there, the secesh ladies, as they were called, would wear their Jeff Davis bonnets with the big bonnet to hide their shamed faces. So...
Changed hands, what, 72 times?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So, Lincoln is going to order Fremont to march from Franklin to Harrisonburg to engage Jackson and Ewell. To quote him, to operate against the enemy in such a way as to relieve Banks. Banks needs some help. He also sent orders to McDowell at Fredericksburg. And his plan was to spring a trap between these three forces. And you can see where the trap is supposed to be. This yellow area right there. Strasburg is supposed to be the anvil, and there's three hammers coming. Now, Banks is going to recross the Potomac, pursue Jackson if he moved up the valley. McDowell's corps would send some troops to move to Front Royal and pursue Jackson's column as it passed by. And then to crush Jackson, he's going to send James Shields, recently arrived from Banks' army, marching back to the valley to be followed by a second division. So, once again, tremendous firepower, tremendous material and men to subdue somebody with 16,000 men. But it, as you'll find out, it's more difficult than you can think. But as a result, instead of the figurative hammer, Shields striking Jackson at an anvil, Fremont, all Lincoln could hope for would be a pincer movement catching Jackson at Strasburg. But you know what the main issue is? Timing. You know, there's perfect timing, and then there's, well, just regular timing, right? So, what you're going to end up with is that Jackson is going to, his scouts tell him that troops are coming his way, and he hightails it to the south and gets out of the strike zone of the hammer. And so they harmlessly run into each other, so to speak, with no real impact. So by June 8th, Jackson's army is encamped at Port Republic east of Harrisonburg. Two federal armies under Major Generals John C. Fremont and James Shields were marching to trapping in another, say it with me, pincer movement, okay, at the point where the north and south forks of the Shenandoah River come together. Dividing his force, Jackson orders Major General Richard Ewell to delay Fremont so that Jackson could defeat Shields. Ewell accomplished this mission at the Battle of Cross Keys on June 8th. Now, of course, you can see right over here, you've got Fremont. You've also got Richard Ewell. And you've got the Battle of Cross Keys, you know, drawn by, you know, an artist correspondent there. Much better map here. Here's the Battle of Cross Keys. The battle begins with skirmishing at Cross Keys Tavern on June 7th. At dawn on the 8th, Colonel Samuel Carroll's regiment of cavalry with artillery and an infantry regiment storm into the village of Port Republic, almost capturing Jackson. Here's another nexus that could have gone terribly wrong for the South. Jackson, though, doesn't get rattled. He basically is going to patch together a hasty defense of the bridge over the North River. Fremont is going to advance from Harrisonburg to the vicinity of the Union Church to begin deploying his brigades. Ewell deploys his infantry behind Mill Creek. It's kind of hard. It's so much stuff on this. But you can kind of see where the lines are starting to form here. You've got the Union right over here. Let's see. Union Church is, I think, right there. It's the Union Church. So this would be Fremont's line here. Mill Creek is down along here. There it is, right there, Mill Creek. So that's kind of the battle lines there. Fremont ordered an advance of his lines towards Mill Creek. Colonel Julius Stahl's brigade on the left advanced to their front, down a valley, crossed a run, and slowly advanced up what will be called Victory Hill. How many people have been to Victory Hill? The terrain is very interesting. And I'll tell you in a second whose victory it was. You can see right over here the 8th New York. Now, these fellas, like I said, they're in somewhat of a concealed position, but what they don't know, and what Stahl, I think, didn't realize, is that Trimble had moved his troops right over here. And so as that 8th New York came over, there was a tremendous single musket blast. So imagine 1,000 muskets going off. According to one of the soldiers, at about 60 paces away. Some of those loaded with buck and ball, that's 4 projectiles. So it was a slaughter. So not only did you have the killed and wounded, but the consternation effect goes through the brigade, really. And so that brigade is kind of in a shambles. Now, Fremont is going to try to coordinate an attack over here. Okay, once again, he's going to try to coordinate over here, but it seems like that what happened over there at Victory Hill really seemingly paralyzes Fremont. And so he's going to move off the field and along the Keyseltown Road. Now, like I said, I didn't want to put so much information. Rick can provide you a lot more information. The battle is a lot of ebb and flow. It's going to go back and forth, and there's this movement and this movement and this deception and this feint. But I wanted to try to put it into a thumbnail as much as I could. So the casualties in the Battle of Cross Keys, 287 for the Confederates, 664 for the Union. But wait, you still have another force to deal with. The Battle of Port Republic. You have James Shields, who is going to be matching or crossing sabers with Jackson there. And here's a kind of a newspaper, Harper's Weekly kind of a display of the Battle of Port Republic. When I go to Port Republic and at Cross Keys, I'd remark at how different the counties are. Shenandoah County is long, okay? Frederick County is compact. Rockingham County is so wide open, and I hope they retain that character so that you can see as close as you can on this right over here. Let's go back one there. There we go. So on the evening of the 8th, Fremont was repulsed, and believing that he faced the entire Valley Army, he drew back to await Shields. The next day, with his army recombined and the river bridges burned, Jackson scored the final victory of the Valley Campaign against Shields at Port Republic. Jackson's and Ewell's divisions, totaling about 6,000 men, engaged 2 brigades of Shields' division, Tyler and Carroll, with about 3,500 men. Shields' men are going to deploy in the area of Lewiston. I couldn't find a really good handy-dandy map like I could for Cross Keys. Lewiston, with the left flank resting on an elevated area called the Lewiston Coaling. What a coaling is an area where you made charcoal for the forges and iron foundries in the area. But it was an elevated area, lower area to the right of it. And so imagine it was like a Gibraltar. It was a place that if you could get some cannons, and that's exactly what the Union forces did. They put some cannons there. The Stonewall Brigade is going to advance, and they're going to falter under that fire from that nasty coaling up there. Now, when I first went there, I expected it to be 1,200 feet tall. What is the elevation at the coaling? Is it maybe 40 feet above you or something? It's not much, but it's enough that if you've got to go from relatively flat ground and then go up and take those guns, it's tough. And so the Stonewall Brigade tried a frontal assault, and they fall back. And so there's going to be some reorganization there. So Tyler counterattacks on his right, making it difficult for the Stonewall Brigade. So it's going to take Taylor's brigade going way out on the right flank. In other words, they just keep going until they're not shelled as heavily. And they do kind of a sweep, pincer movement once again. And it's going to sweep down that line. Now, Tyler retreats and Fremont slowly advances to the north bank of the South River. So he's there to help, but he doesn't really... is not able to levy a lot of support. But he does post some guns on the river bluffs, fires at Jackson's line as he withdraws, and causes a little bit of a fuss. Fremont's going to go to Harrisonburg after dark the next night on June 10th. The casualties you're talking about, 816 for the Confederacy, about 1,002 for the Union forces. This battle really is the culmination of a dazzling campaign of maneuver against superior Union forces using things I've already told you. Surprise, swift marching, swift concentration of forces. And the victory in this campaign ultimately freed the valley from Union troops, which meant Jackson could now redeploy and go and aid Lee against McClellan. Now here's what I find really tragic for Jackson, and you know this. He comes to the valley with all of these laurels. I think he was probably a little embarrassed by it. Henry Kai Douglas passed on in his book I wrote with Stonewall, my favorite Jackson quote. Jackson is supposed to have said, if my coat knows my plans, I'm going to take it off and throw it away. So he liked to keep everybody else aloof. But he comes to Lee on the peninsula there. Okay, he doesn't have a super hyper-accurate map. He doesn't know the land. He's got to be mentally fatigued. And so people are looking at Jackson to almost have the Energizer Bunny energy level. And so he doesn't, in some cases, live up to expectations. But once again, apples and oranges. But you notice that he was in the valley. He knew the valley. He had local people. He had an advantage. Take that away, would those numerical superiority levels made a big difference? Perhaps. So, my last slide here. Stonewall Jackson's military exploits are being studied around the world to this day. Okay, somebody has studied that campaign today, all around the world. But why? He demonstrates rather naturally what a small force can do with a charismatic leader. We don't have to look too far to see that in modern history. The Viet Cong, for example. The Taliban. I mean, once again, charismatic leadership, a small cohesive outfit, good intelligence, initiative, and most importantly, surprise. Surprise. One Union soldier wrote home and told his parents that Jackson, he thought he was like a wizard, that literally he was under every bushel. He was in every stew pot. He was everywhere. Even though he wasn't, the fear of that is a tremendous weapon. And that's something that Jackson is going to use. And so on that note, I turn the floor over to my esteemed colleague, Rick Britton.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.